Tonight our speaker's name is Rob S. He's from Fresno, as I mentioned. He has a sobriety date of 3/12/2008, which means what? He has 6 years and 364 days of sobriety. So tomorrow, if he makes it through this meeting, he will have 7 years. Right? So let's give him a hand for that. Hey, his favorite AA slogan is easy do it, but do it. So I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Rob from Fresno. Come on up, Rob.
How's it going? I'm Rob. I'm an alcoholic. It's my favorite saying is easy does it, but do it. It's a good saying. I'm kind of nervous, so I hope you guys will bear with me. There's a lot of you guys out there. I got a home group. My home group is the What's Up with the Big Book meeting. What's up?
What's up?
Over there we say what's up whenever they, people relate to anything. If you feel like saying what's up because you relate with something, that's alright with me too. It's kind of like when you say amen in church, they say what's up. It's like, I just got another DUI. Well, what's up? You know what I mean? It's like that. So I got a sobriety date. You mentioned my sobriety date is March 12, 2008. I got a sponsor. My current sponsor's name is Tommy R. He's my second sponsor. I've worked the steps, and I continue to work the steps, and I get the privilege of working the steps with other men today. And I'm pretty sure that I wouldn't be sober if I wasn't doing that right now. So, if you're new or relatively new and you forget everything else I'm about to say, I highly encourage you to get a sponsor. I don't know anybody around here that would basically be here if they didn't have a sponsor and they didn't participate in getting together with that sponsor on a regular basis. And that's my story. I'll tell you a little bit about like what it was like. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic because I got 3 DUIs. Right? So, having a number of alcoholics don't make you an alcoholic, or a number of DUIs don't make you an alcoholic. But in my experience, if you have several, it might be a good indicator. That was a joke. Okay, anyways. Is this thing on? All right. So, like I said, they don't laugh when they're supposed to laugh, but they will laugh. So, I've also been, some of my other baseball card stats are, I've been deported from Canada. You're like, how does that happen? I don't know. It happened to me. Don't get a lot of what's up on that. You know what I mean? Doesn't happen to a lot of people, but that happened to me. And I had a lot of other crazy things happen to me, but, for the most part, I'm an alcoholic, and this is basically what I had to figure out when I first sat down with my sponsor, because when I start drinking, I'm not sure how much I'm going to drink, and when I want to stop, and I have every reason to stop and stay stopped, I can't stay stopped on my own. My story is that I grew up over here in Fresno. My father was, for the most part, absent from my life. I thought that was a big deal. It turns out it's not such a big deal, but that's part of my story, and I think that it's something that my disease kind of used to make me feel different from other people. And so I grew up, and I was always kind of the smart-ass kid in the back of the class. Right? I know there's a few of you in here, right? I was always the guy that was like, oh, come on, that's the best you're going to do. Haven't you done your homework? All this sort of stuff or whatever, right? I always had to have the answers so that I could feel better than, because I felt less than other people for various reasons. And, for the most part, I didn't drink when I was in high school. I drank a handful of times. I had a vague notion that maybe me and alcohol wouldn't be a good idea. My grandfather died of cirrhosis of the liver at 44. I don't know, I just didn't drink during high school. I started going to church at 17 for the same reason every other guy who's 17-year-old does. What's up? You got that is the right answer? And so I followed a girl in there, and I met some really cool people. And I did that for a while, but what I fell into was kind of a transactional relationship with whatever's in control of the universe. I said, I'll do this, I'll go to Bible study, I'll do that, on Wednesday, I'll go to church on Sunday, but I gotta get mine on the back end, you know what I mean? This relationship better work out, I better get this job, that better happen, and, if you don't know, unfortunately, that's not the way the creator of the universe works, and it didn't work out real well for me when I was doing that. So after a while, I said, well, to hell with this, and I kind of went my own way. And going my own way at around 21 looked like I was going to college down in San Diego. I felt like I was well on my way. I was real scared I wasn't ever going to graduate. I started to get to where I was like nearing graduation, and I started doing things like going to TJ and coming home with head wounds. And there you go. And, you know, if you guys will know what I'm talking about. And, you know, and I just would tell myself, well, you know, this stuff's happening because I'm, like, out of practice. Like all these other people, they started when they were 15, right? And I got to catch up with them, right? So, you know, more and more stuff would happen. When I was 22, got out of a two-year relationship with a girl I really thought I was in love with. And, you know, I remember being at a graduation party, and someone told me I drank like 3/4 of a bottle of SoCo, and I woke up in the back of an ambulance, and I had a blood alcohol poisoning. And, you know, blood alcohol poisoning don't make you an alcoholic, like I said, but these are just some of the things that happened to me, right? So my BAC was like 0.37, and they told me that, you know, if I'd hit, I was well over 0.4 for a while, and they said that, you know, you could have died. They said 50% of the people that hit 0.4 could have died, and the overwhelming thing that went through my mind was like, man, I'm just really unlucky, right? That's the best way I can describe how my life was when I was drinking, is I just had the overwhelming feeling that I was really unlucky. I felt like really lucky for a long time, and then it seemed like all the cards start going a different way. And you know, I got my first DUI when I was 25, and I was really bummed out about that. And I can't believe they gave it to me. You know, I was going, it was 2:00 in the morning, I was in a Mustang, a red Mustang with the top down. There were two girls in the car, and they pulled me over, and I couldn't believe it. You know, I was in total shock, and I felt really unlucky. And the first DUI really bummed me out. The second DUI, about a year and a half later, didn't really faze me. And again, I just thought I was real unlucky. I ended up coming back to Fresno. I was living up in the Bay Area. I ended up coming back to Fresno and living on my mom's couch for about a year in the trailer park, and thinking, you know, all I wanted to do was get out of Fresno, and I was gone from Fresno for 5 years in San Diego and in the Bay Area for 5 years, and here I am, washed out and back, and I can't believe it, man. I just don't know how I ended up in this situation. I could not make the correlation between that, like when I was drinking and I did other things, and that's part of my story, I did other things, but my biggest problem was that I could not stop drinking. You know, I was able to substitute a lot of different things, and so when I came back to Fresno, I said, that's it, I'm not doing anything else, and I'm just going to drink, I should just be able to drink. And I remember doing like 26 days. Let me back up a little bit. I remember doing 26 days in Elmwood in Milpitas for my second DUI, and I remember writing on this piece of paper, you know, it said, you know, I don't like wearing orange clothes, I don't like eating cold bologna sandwiches, I hate Telemundo, I have like no desire to sleep in a room with like 40 other dudes, and I don't know what it is I'm so angry about, but like whatever it is, it's not worth my freedom. And I know that when I get out of here, I'm going to quit drinking, and I'm not going to talk to that family, and da 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 da, and all this stuff. And I know that I had every intention when I got out of jail of basically not drinking or doing anything, and I know that I was drinking within a few weeks. And you know, I just couldn't connect the dots. So I ended up back in Fresno, at my mom's, and I ended up getting a job, and I started to put my life back together a little bit, and I cut other substances out of the equation for me, and I just drank, you know, and I was a bar drinker. You know, I went to the bar, the other bar, the next bar. That's the names of the bars in Fresno. They don't have other names. They just have those, that's their names. And I was there a lot, and you know, when I drank, you know, I liked to do, I felt like more in control when I drank. Other people, I would hear them say really weird things like, I'm good. Like, that never came out of my mouth. I was never like, I'm good. I'm cool. I'm okay. I was always like, if I have a little bit, more is better. You know, for me, because for me, when I put alcohol in my system, see, I don't feel out of control. I feel more in control. I would often say things like, let's go fly fighter jets. Let's do heart surgery. Like, you know, we got those guys, and we didn't have those guys. Like, I got her number, like, and I didn't have her number. And, you know, I just felt more in control when I drank. And I didn't understand that other people, by and large, most of the rest of the population does not feel that way. I really thought that everybody felt that way. And so I didn't understand why they were not doing it more like I was doing it. So things started happening for me where I would come into work and they made me sign a piece of paper that said if I come into work drunk or hungover or anything that they're going to fire me. And again, I remember sitting there and I felt like I was in a movie scene with this guy and I was like, man, I am so unlucky. Again, that's what I just think, so unlucky. I can't believe they're making me sign this piece of paper. And there was a time when I had to, it was in November of 07, I knew I had to be there that day at work. I had to be there. My boss told me, look, I'm not going to be here. You have to be here. And I only went out to drink a couple of drinks the night before. And I woke up at 10 a.m. the next morning. And I go into work. And I'm trying to play it off. And he's like, man, you're wasted. You got to go home. And I had to wait to figure out if I still had my job on Monday. And I thought, here we go. I'm going to lose another lucrative job. And I didn't really understand why that was happening. And I was going through my second DUI course, and it took me like 4+ years to go through that. It's an 18-month course. I got no degree for that, no letters after my name or anything, but it took me a really long time. And one thing that somebody did say in there was, if you got 2 DUIs and you keep drinking, you're going to get another one. And I thought, thank you very much. Not going to happen to me. I'll be cool. And what that person did for me was they drew a line out there. And when I crossed over it, I thought, now how did they know that, right? How did he know that was going to happen? And so what happened was I went on a Monday night to a bar because I didn't drink every day. You know what I mean? I didn't drink every day. I just drank on Monday nights when it was, you know, Monday night football. Tuesday night we had pool league. Wednesday was hump day. Thursday, there's only one more day of the weekend, right? Friday, it's definitely on. Saturday, it's still on. Sunday, it's football or whatever. And I didn't drink on every day, but on most of those days, I found a reason to drink, right? But I told myself, I'm not drinking every day. But on most of those days, I had a reason to drink. So, you know, I was at Monday night. I had not driven. This is how I drank. When I got my last DUI on March 11th in 2008, 7 years ago today, I had not driven to the bar. How do you not drive to the bar and come home with a DUI? I don't know, but I did it. So what happened was my friend drove me there, and you know, a girl that I was dating showed up there, and he took off, and it was Monday night. We were practicing for pool. It was Monday or Tuesday night. We were practicing for pool, and I looked at her. We were getting ready to go, and I meant to have one pitcher of beer. That's what I meant. I meant to have one pitcher of beer. And then what happened was this guy left $100 on the bar, and I said, we don't leave $100 on the bar in this bar. Explicative, you know, someone's going to take your money. I mean, he was such a nice guy to me, he bought me another pitcher, and I've never not drank some alcohol that somebody gave me. So I drank that. So then I'm 2 pitchers deep, and then I'm like, well, one more pitcher, and then like by the fourth one, I'm like, well, we might as well finish this off. So I was 4 pitchers deep on a Monday or Tuesday night, and it really wasn't nothing to me. And I thought, I'm straighter than she is, and I should just drive home. So we drove home. The lights come on in the back of the light, and I thought, oh no, here we go again. Fresno and Escalon pull me over. They put me into the back seat of the cop car, and I remember looking at myself through the grate and saying to myself, and I never been to an AA meeting or nothing like that, but I just thought, man, I've got to do something different. I don't know what, but I got to do something different. And so I thought for sure, I caught some breaks in my court case. They punished me like it was my second DUI instead of my third one. I thought for sure, in my early sobriety, I was way too concerned with my finances. I was way too concerned with my job. I was very precariously close to going back to drinking and maybe dying. And I was concerned with all these things that didn't really matter, that now I can see didn't really matter that much. But I was real concerned with that stuff. And anyway, so I got the DUI. I went to a lawyer. The lawyer said, you got to go to some meetings. And I was like, look, I can walk the line for a little bit. You know, you tell me, drop and give you 50, go run some laps, whatever it is you want me to do. I can do that for a while. Like, I can stay on the straight and narrow for a while if that's what I got to do to keep my job. And this guy's like, go to 3 meetings a week. I was like, I'll go to 5. You know, I'll go to 6. I don't care. And I went to a lot of meetings. And as I start going to these meetings, you know, weird things start happening. And I remember this really old, lonely guy came up to me, and he's like, you know, he started talking to me, and he asked me what was going on with me, and I, you know, let loose the floodgates on him, and I was telling him, and he's like, well, hey, do you want to get together and read this book? And I'm like, and he was referring to this book right here. If you don't have one, I highly suggest you get one. If you can't afford one, ask somebody in here. They'll get it for you, or ask me. We'll get you a book before you leave here. But the guy said, he's like, you want to get together and read this book? And I was like, okay. And I kind of felt like he was lonely. I just thought he wanted, like, someone to talk to, you know what I mean? And I was like, he's kind of old and, like, on his last legs. And I was like, well, okay. And I'm like, when? And he's like, how about now? And I was like, okay. So, I'm over there at Sierra Fellowship. And he's like, well, I'm riding around on my bicycle because I don't have a driver's license. And he's like, well, I can't fit your bike in the back of my car. And I'm like, stumped. I'm like, so what do we do? And he's like, well, just follow me on your bike. And I'm like, and I'm about 20 days in right now. And I'm like, okay. And so I'm following this old, lonely dude in this broke-down Camry, like, it's probably older than me, down the road on my bicycle to God knows where. I don't even know where I'm going. And I just think this is what it's come to. This is what it's come to. And, you know, that seemed like the jumping off place for me. It seemed pretty bad right there. And little did I know that that was the beginning of a whole new life for me, and my life getting better. And he would say really weird things to me, man. He would say, like, he'd be like, Rob, if you're alcoholic. And no one ever talked to me like that, because everybody else always told me I had a problem, see? They didn't let me make up my mind for myself. And he said, and finally I got up the nerve, you know, to ask him. I was like, you keep saying, if I'm alcoholic. I'm like, if you don't think I'm alcoholic, then maybe I don't need to be here. You know? And he's like, and this is about the third or fourth time I met with him, and he's like, Rob, he's like, it don't matter. His name was Jack. And he said, Rob, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what your girlfriend thinks. It doesn't matter what your boss thinks. It doesn't matter what your parents think. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. It only matters what you think. And if you don't know if you're an alcoholic, then we need to help you figure that out. And he basically didn't take me to the place in the book, and he didn't make it real clear for me, and he didn't point it out. But basically the way I took that was, sweet, there's a way out. All I have to do is prove that I'm not alcoholic by this guy's standards, and eventually when my stuff gets better, I can go back to doing what I want to do. And honestly, I'm kind of a bookwormish guy, and that's basically what I did. I set out to basically prove that I wasn't an alcoholic with this guy. And but he did something really great for me, and that is that he evaluated my willingness by my actions rather than what was coming out of my mouth, because he knew that I wasn't capable of telling the truth. And he gave me opportunities to demonstrate willingness by asking me to do things and seeing if I would follow up on them, and I was desperate enough to do them. And you know, and I later learned that that I thought that I was manufacturing that willingness, and I later learned that that willingness wasn't coming from me, it was coming from somewhere else. And so, you know, we started to get together, and we met on a regular basis. Him and I would meet on Saturday mornings. I would usually do my step work on late Friday evening. I usually felt like if the least I could do, I figured, was this guy's willing to meet with me, I feel like I'm getting free therapy, the least I can do is basically show up for this guy and not basically blow him off. And if I was late, he let me know that he wasn't too hot with me being late. And but we met, and he would answer questions in a really weird way. You know, I remember we had met like several times. I didn't even know what a sponsor was, and everybody's talking about a sponsor and this and that and the other thing, and I was like, so Jack, I'm like, are you my sponsor? And he's like, I don't know. You want to call me that? And I'm like, I don't know. And then, like, I left there, and as I, like, while I was on my way riding my bicycle on the way home, I was like, I still don't know if he's my sponsor. And so, but we kept meeting, you know what I mean? And so we kept meeting, and then we came up on this part, and we started coming through some stuff in the program, and, you know, we spent a long time on step one. What he told me was that there's 164 pages in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first 104 pages are on the 12 steps. He told me that, like, 60-plus of those pages are basically on step one. He's like, what that means is step one is real important. That means they really want you to get step one. See, because if all the steps were of equal importance, they'd split them up, right? 104 pages, they split it up by 12, there'd be like 8 pages a step. That's how it would be, right? Or whatever the math is, I don't know. But the point is, it's not like that. The point is, they continue through the doctor's opinion and the forewords and all the way up until we agnostics, they're still talking about the first step. That means they really want you to understand the first step. And I hear a lot of people, and me too, I'm like, yeah, clearly I'm powerless. I must be powerless because I'm 31 years old riding around on my bicycle. And you know, when I had, that was later I found that to be a blessing for me because what I found was that, you know, I was like, maybe I'm making too big a deal of this, you know, like these people, they're way worse than me, they're older, you know, I'm younger, I'm only 31, like these people look really old, and this is a nice, young, attractive room of people, like where I was going to meetings, like they were all real old, and like, and it wasn't like this room in here, and like, and I was just like, I don't really, you know, my disease was still looking for a way for me to be different, any way that it could find. And so, you know, we're going through the first step, and he's really hitting that home onto me, and I thought I was powerless because I was focused on all the things, the external things. You know, I was focused on the losing the job, I was focused on riding the bicycle, the cleaning out the toilets down at Fresno County Jail, you know, doing the yard work for Fresno County, all this stuff, and I thought that's why I was powerless. And he basically helped to show me why I really was powerless according to this book. And he showed me physically how I was powerless, but basically that I have an allergy, and I did not understand that the alcoholic is a sick person, that there is something physically different about people that suffer from alcoholism. I did not know that. I thought it was a cop-out. My dad wasn't around. My grandfather wasn't around. And I said, these people just copped out. And I basically wasn't willing to let them off the hook with my resentment towards them, so I stayed stuck on stupid that there wasn't something physically different about people that suffered from alcoholism for a while. I don't know if that makes sense to anybody. If it doesn't, you know, if it does, talk to me, whatever. So what I found, though, was I'm real interested in, like, the way that people go from, like, not understanding things to understanding and how they go from, like, a transitory state, how they move through that. So I was convinced that alcohol was not a physical problem. I was convinced it was a mental problem. And then he started exposing me to all this stuff in the book that was talking about it being physical. And I couldn't buy it, and I was real defiant, and still am, and it causes less havoc in my life now than it used to, but it still gets the best of me sometimes. And but I was honest with him, and he appreciated that, and he would work through things with me. And I thought, well, you know, at one time I did have a friend in college. His name was Alex, and he happened to be Asian, and he suffered from like this flushed reaction thing. Like he would have you'd have like one beer, and he would look like I looked after having 20 beers. Right? And you could physically see on his face that something was different with him, right? And I remember, well, clearly there is something physically different about that guy than me. And when Jack was talking about this, I thought, well, if there's something different about that guy than me, that alcohol affects him differently, there could be something differently about me that alcohol affects me differently from other people that causes me to crave it more, right? And you know, and we hit this part in the book in the doctor's opinion where it talks about it explained many things for which we could not otherwise account. See, that time in November of 07 where I had every reason to, like, not come into work drunk or hungover, I didn't want to lose that job, I had every intention of not doing that, I have no explanation for that situation. Unless I suffer from a physical allergy, like,
There's no explanation for that situation. But once I introduce the physical, or once someone else, or whatever's in control of the universe, introduces the concept of the physical allergy into that equation, that basically once I pop, I can't stop. Once I put some alcohol in my system, like, I'm not sure how it's going to go. That does explain why that happened to me. And I have no other explanation. And I started to look back over the course of my life and see that there were many other things that I had no explanation for. And I started to think, you know, this thing, this allergy thing they're talking about, the book came out in 34. This is before all the DNA stuff and like Francis and Crick and all this stuff. And I thought, I mean, it's basically, I started to think of it like a genetic thing. And that's the way I think of it now. And I know the book don't say genetic, but that's the way I think of it. I believe that in my body, in every cell in my body, in the nucleus of every cell, there's a sequence of A, T, C's, and G's. That when I put alcohol into my system, something different happens to me than other people. And it causes me to feel more in control, and it causes me to keep going more and drinking more than other people. And I did not know that that was the case. And it took me a long time to come to that realization. And I wouldn't have come to that realization without a sponsor. So he got me into talking about the mental obsession, and I thought, well, this is good. Now that I know this, I should be straight. I should be all right. I know that I won't find myself in this situation again, right? And I had about 6 months of sobriety, and I remember there was this guy in one of my meetings, and I really didn't like this guy too much. And he said, there's probably some people in this room, and this is a big fat drunk trap, so please don't fall into it, but I'm going to tell you it because it helped me and I almost fell into it, all right? He said, you know, there's probably some people in this room that ain't real alcoholics. And I started thinking, well, maybe that's me, right? Like, maybe I'm just unlucky again. And I was thinking about that for like a long time. And finally, I got up the nerve to ask my sponsor about it. And he said, Rob, do you realize that you're suffering from the mental obsession? The idea that somehow, someday, you will control and enjoy your drinking? And I thought, here I am. I'm going to community service on my third DUI. Been deported from Canada. Had my nose broken multiple times. I got gravel in my face from getting hit upside the head with 2x4s. I got all these situations. I've done all this work to identify that I have the allergy when it comes to drinking alcohol. And like, all it does is take some jackass in a meeting to say, like, maybe there's some people in this room that ain't real alcoholics, and I'm ready to jump ship. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go right back out the door. I'm ready to go right back at it. I'm ready for a whole bunch more misery. I'm ready to go do it. And at that point, I realized that left to my own devices on a long enough timeline, I was going to drink again. And that I needed something greater than myself to help me with that. And so I got to look it right in the eye, my sponsor, as a result of being willing to call my sponsor when weird things were going through my head, and that willingness, by the way, didn't come from me. I believe it comes from somewhere else. By being willing to do that and look the mental obsession right in the eye and see really how powerless I am. See, I'm not powerless just when the alcohol hits me. I'm powerless with no alcohol in my system. No alcohol in my system for long periods of time. My mind will manufacture ways to basically get me back in the ringer. And that is a very scary proposition when you realize that. And at that point, I started to bear down a little bit harder on my step work. So I went through my first, I started going through my steps, and the big problem for me with my steps was that, I went through my first, how I got into the God thing, I thought I tried the God thing, and what I learned was I hadn't tried the God thing. I had tried, basically, I really related in step two in the 12 and 12 when it talks about there's these, you know, if you got a problem with God, I really encourage you to look at step two in the 12 and 12. Like, there's a bunch of different categories of people in there, and they got different problems, and there's a bunch of different solutions they have. And I thought I had tried the God thing, and I thought it didn't work for me, and this wasn't going to work for me because of that. And what I found was, I hadn't tried the God thing. What I had done was, I had tried telling God what to do. I had set up contracts and spreadsheets for God, right? That it was going to go like this. This is how it was supposed to happen. And this were how the dominoes were supposed to fall. And what I learned is that ain't really trying God. That's
just another form of self-will. That's another form of me laying out how the universe is supposed to go and trying to direct the show. And so then I got into my first four step, and I was unable to basically find all the relief. If you're doing a four step, it's all in the fourth column. All of it's in the fourth column. You can do the rest of the four step real good. If you can't find your part, there's no relief. That's my experience. And my first time through a four step, I could not find my part. It was still everybody else's fault. I was still super unlucky. I was still a victim. And I did my fifth step, and my sponsor told me to go home and review the fifth step promises, and I came back to him and I said, okay, Jack, I said, I am not, one of the fifth step promises is that you will feel like you're walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And I told him, I said, I am not walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And he was prepared for that. I distinctly remember him not breathing or blinking, but immediately he said, well, I guess we missed something, we better go back. I was like, go back where? And he's like, go back to the beginning. I don't know what we missed. And so for me, that was a grow or go moment. Like, I was either going to basically say, to hell with you, I'm not going back, and go my own way and go back to doing the things that I was doing, or I was going to stick that out. And basically, I didn't, you know, I was, some young people in here, I was basically, you know what, out of luck and no options. And so as a result, I said, I guess I better do that. And this time when we went through the steps, I was really paying attention a little bit more at about 9 months sobriety because I didn't want to have to go through it a third time. So we started doing that, and that time through the steps, I really did start to see where I was selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid. I did see where I had made decisions based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. I did see where I had knocked over the first domino, and I didn't feel unlucky anymore. And I can say this, that one of the best things that Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is I'm no longer a victim. I'm not a victim of circumstance. I'm not a victim of birth. I'm not a victim of, I'm not just some guy wandering around the universe getting hit by lightning bolts. What I'm doing is I'm a guy that's walking around the universe most of the time sticking forks into electrical sockets. And they're being like, what happened? Like, what? I don't understand, right? And so, you know, that was pretty amazing to me. And also at that time, you know, I had done this really smart thing. Well, basically what was I was in what I'll call a security blanket relationship. I had no intention of being with that girl after a period of time. But I didn't want to be by myself. And I was effectively using her as a security blanket. And in the book it talks about if we continue to harm other people with our sex conduct, we're quite sure to drink again. And that almost happened to me. What happened was, I really wasn't even that into her. And she stood me up on a date, and I said, I can't believe this chick stood me up. And she went to a bar, and I said, I'm going to go to that bar, and I'm going to give her a piece of my mind. And I had the flash. It flashed on me like a moment of inspiration. Said, you know what, if you go to that bar, someone's probably going to say something to you. You're probably not going to take it real well. You're going to be in a tussle with them, and you're going to have a charge. And you're gonna drink over that. And this guy, who's not sober anymore, took me to a Starbucks and talked me down for 4 or 5 hours because I couldn't get a hold of my sponsor. And pointed out to me that this is how me making decisions based on self when it comes to sex has put me in a position to almost drink again and get loaded and be back in the meat grinder. And that's my experience, you know. And so I got out of that security blanket relationship, and for the first time in my life, I had what was like mandatory enforced singlehood. Because I don't really have any game, you know. I'm like, I don't have enough game like some people do to be like riding around on their bicycles and like be like, hey, baby, how about my handlebars? Let's go to the movies. You know what I mean? Because some people got that kind of game, and I don't have that kind of game. You know what I mean? And so I knew that, so I wasn't going to get my license for like another 9 months. And so it was like mandatory enforced singlehood, right? And see, this is the point where they're laughing again. I'm not sure if I meant them to laugh or not. I don't know. Anyways, so we'll go with it, though. We'll go with it. And so, anyways, like, I had mandatory enforced singlehood, and it gave me basically the time to focus on me just doing steps. And from about 9 months to about a year and 3 months is when most of a lot of light bulbs started coming on for me. And I got So basically, you know, my life has been a lot different. I got involved with this young people's group. What's up, young people's back there, all those young people's? I'm a firm believer that if you think you're different in some way, you need to go find some people like that and remove that reservation. You know, I thought I was too young for Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I would go to this young people's group, and I was 31, and there'd be these girls who I thought were girls, and they would say something, and I was like, that woman is clearly more mature than I am, because I would not have responded to that situation in that fashion. So, maybe these people have something I want, and I have something to learn here, and I'm not so... And I felt like for the first time in my life I wasn't ahead of the curve, but that I was behind the curve. And I got involved with young people's, and it helped to remove this reservation that I was too young to stay sober. Because if you're in this room and you're thinking you're too young, you're wrong. Just straight up, I can just tell you, you're wrong. I know someone that's younger than you that's sober for a long time. I know them all over the state. And I basically got to be involved with this young people's group. And my main problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. And I really like the way that Chuck C. explains it in the book, A New Pair of Glasses. He describes selfishness and self-centeredness as ego. And he describes it as a feeling of conscious separation from. And he has this little picture of like the universe and God and everything in it. And then this little picture of a stick figure out here, separate from everything else. And that's how I felt all the time. I felt a little bit different than everybody else most of the time. And see, what being in young people helped me to do was, it helped me to basically feel a part of. It helped me to feel that I had a place where I could go, and I wasn't just a junior member in AA, but I had something to bring to the table and something to contribute. And, you know, I feel really blessed. I've gotten to experience such amazing things in young people's. We bid for this conference for multiple years. We got this conference to come to Fresno. There was over 2,000 people at this conference, and I stood in a building that my grandfather, who died of cirrhosis of the liver, built, and my mom remembers being at, and I stood on the stage in front of these 2,000 people, and I got to see all these people, like probably 1,000 of them, for the first time at this conference, basically get to feel that lack of feeling apart from. I got to feel their little stick figure come into the circle for just maybe the first time in their life, and it is amazing. And I can't explain that to you if you haven't experienced it, but take my word for it. It's worth working for, and it is amazing. So, you know, and I started sponsoring people, and I'm a big believer that if you don't give it back, you're not going to stay here. I have to give it away to keep it. I know for a fact that, like what we read earlier, that nothing will so much ensure immunity as intensive work with other alcoholics. And I'm saying this, and I hope you don't think it's boastful, because it's not. Because my sponsor says if you got a lot of sponsees, you might be a little bit crazier than other people. But I meet on Monday with Brian back there. I meet on Tuesday with my sponsor. On Wednesday, I meet with Jason. On Thursday, I meet with Chad. On Wednesday, I also meet with Shane. I meet with two guys on Wednesday. And on Friday, I meet with Colin back there. And that's how my weeks go. And sometimes those guys cancel, but that's what I do. And it keeps me real, real level-headed and real straight, and gives me a whole lot better life than I got coming to me. And I can't explain to you why that is until you actually do it. That's one of the things that you just kind of have to take on faith, that basically all the people that got multiple years in this program, they're all sponsoring other people, is my experience. And I don't know people that stick around here that don't do that. And, you know, I'll read a couple things from the book, and then I'll be done. Thanks for letting me go a little bit over here. But, you know, I struggle with the third step. I still struggle with the third step, you know. And like I said, I'm real interested in how someone goes, and, you know, the third step is making a decision to turn your will and your life over the care of whatever's in control of the universe as you understand it. And And I struggle with that. And people say, let go and let God. Like, what does that mean? Like, how do you do that? You know what I mean? And I just want to share with you how that works mechanically in my mind. See, when I find that I got something that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent over, and I need to give it to whatever's in control of the universe, basically what I do is I review the third step relationships. I go back and I say, it talks about God was going to be our director. I say, what's the director do? The director gives directions to the actors. The actors fulfill the role. I'm the actor. I have a role here to fulfill. That's what I do. He's the father. I'm the child. What does the father do for children? The father provides for the child what the child can't provide for itself. That's what he does for me. I review that he's the principal. I'm the agent. It's his will, not mine. He's the employer. I'm the employee. He provides the work. He signs the checks. And I show up and do the work. And when I review all those things in my mind, then I say the third step prayer, and it makes a little bit more sense to me. And as a result of doing that, you know, for the most part, on a daily basis, I get to experience the third step promises. I get to experience new power flowing in. I get to enjoy peace of mind. I've discovered that I can face life successfully, life on life's terms. I become conscious of his presence for the most part on a daily basis. And you know what? I didn't know this. I didn't know it when I got here, but I was full of fear, man. And for the most part today, I have begun to lose my fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. And I feel pretty much reborn. And compared to what I was doing before, this is a really, really good gig. It's a really good deal. If you don't know if you're an alcoholic, you're in the right place. This is where you're supposed to be at. I challenge you to get a sponsor. I challenge you to be as defiant as I was. I challenge you to prove it to yourself that you aren't. But be open-minded and try and understand if you have that allergy, if you have that obsession, and if you do, you're in the right spot. I want to thank everybody for their time. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Phil, for asking me to come. Give yourselves a hand for 12-step and me. Thanks a lot. All right, let's hear it for Rob one more time. Hey, we're